A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's the kind of question that makes you put down your coffee. The Jerusalem municipality dropped findings yesterday. 600 million shekels in damage to the light rail. 2-year project delay. And the culprit isn't Hamas rockets or Hezbollah tunnels. It's Haredi rioters who don't want a train passing through their neighborhood, even though it doesn't run on Shabbat. Which forces a question that a lot of Israelis are asking themselves quietly, and not so quietly. Is the most serious threat to Israel's long-term survival now internal, not external? Daniel wants to know how politicians have grappled with this, what options are actually on the table, and whether this is a pipeline waiting to explode. So we're going to move past the culture war headlines, and look at the structural mechanics of this crisis. The laws, the budgets, the demographics, and what happens when a segment of your own population starts sabotaging the infrastructure.
That 600 million shekel figure is not just a vandalism bill. It's the price tag of a 30-year political strategy that has brought Israel to a breaking point. And I want to be precise about what we're discussing, because this topic attracts more heat than light. The Haredi community is not a monolith. There are significant moderate factions, the Haredalim, the national religious Haredim, who serve in the military, who work, who participate. But the political leadership and a vocal activist core operate from a theological position that rejects Zionism entirely, viewing the secular state as an impediment to the messianic era. That's not hyperbole. That's the stated position of key rabbinical authorities who guide the voting blocks.
Which creates a very strange situation. You have a community whose political representatives sit in the government, control ministries, direct billions in state funding, and whose spiritual leadership teaches that the state itself is illegitimate. It's like being the landlord of a building, where one tenant doesn't believe in property rights, but keeps demanding you fix the plumbing.
That's exactly the tension. And the light rail sabotage is not an isolated tantrum about a train. It's a logical escalation of what happens when political accommodation hits its limit and the activists decide direct action is the next tool. To understand why it happened, you have to understand the legal and political machinery that created the conditions for it. Let's start with the military draft, the single most contentious issue in Israeli politics for the last decade.
The draft exemption is the engine of this entire dynamic. Walk us through where it stands right now.
The history, and fast forward since the founding of the state, there was an arrangement where full-time yeshiva students could defer military service. It was originally a few hundred people. By the 2000s, it was tens of thousands. In 2014, the Knesset passed a law attempting to phase in conscription with criminal penalties for draft dodgers. It never got enforced. The coalition collapsed, elections happened, the law got shelved. Fast forward to June 2025, the Supreme Court ruled that the blanket exemption was unconstitutional, violating the principle of equality. The court gave the government a deadline to pass new legislation. In March 2026, the coalition passed what's called the Service Targets Law.
Service Targets Law is one of those names that means the opposite of what it sounds like.
It's a masterpiece of legislative misdirection. The law sets annual targets for Haredi conscription, starts at about 4,800 in 2026, rising to around 10,000 by 2030. Sounds like progress. But here's the mechanism. If the targets aren't met, there are no enforcement provisions. No criminal penalties, no financial sanctions on yeshivas, no individual consequences for draft dodgers. The law creates the appearance of conscription without the reality. The IDF Manpower Directorate reported that as of this year, 28% of draft-age males are exempted, and that number is climbing.
The Supreme Court says the exemption is unconstitutional, and the coalition responds by passing a law that changes the stationery but not the policy. That's a very specific form of political craftsmanship.
It reveals the core dynamic. Haredi parties, Shas, and United Torah Judaism have functioned as the kingmaker in nearly every coalition since 2019. No government has been able to form without them. Their price for joining is always the same. Protect the exemption, increase the yeshiva budgets, maintain autonomy over education. And they've been extraordinarily effective at extracting that price.
Let's put numbers on that. What does increase the yeshiva budgets actually mean in shekels?
In the 2025 state budget, 4.2 billion shekels were allocated to yeshiva stipends and Haredi educational institutions. To put that in perspective, the entire public university system, every university, every college, every research grant, received 1.8 billion. So the state is spending more than twice as much on institutions that don't teach math, English, or science than it spends on the entire higher education system that produces its engineers, doctors, and entrepreneurs.
That's a structural decision, not an accidental line item. And it creates a self-perpetuating cycle. If you don't teach core secular subjects, you produce graduates who can't enter the modern workforce. If they can't enter the workforce, they remain dependent on state stipends. If they're dependent on state stipends, they vote for the parties that promise to maintain those stipends. The system designs its own permanence.
And the demographic math makes this cycle terrifying from a policy perspective. The Haredi birth rate is 6.5 children per family. The secular Jewish birth rate is about 2.5. The Israel Democracy Institute projects that Haredim will make up 25% of Israel's population by 2035. The Bank of Israel's 2026 annual report identified Haredi non-participation in the workforce as, quote, the single largest structural risk to long-term GDP growth.
Let's sit with that phrase. The central bank of the country is saying that the biggest threat to the economy isn't regional instability, isn't the tech sector slowdown, isn't global inflation. It's the fact that a rapidly growing segment of the population has a male workforce participation rate of about 50% versus 85% nationally. You can't run a modern welfare state on that math.
The geography concentrates the problem. Haredi populations are clustered in Jerusalem and Beit Shemesh. These are not distributed evenly across the country. The Jerusalem municipality's annual report showed a 40% increase in poverty-related spending between 2022 and 2025, directly linked to Haredi non-participation in the workforce. You get what economists call a poverty trap. Low workforce participation depresses property values, which reduces the municipal tax base, which reduces services, which makes the area less attractive for businesses, which further depresses economic activity.
Which brings us back to the light rail. Because Jerusalem's mayor, Moshe Lion, has been unable or unwilling to enforce building codes, zoning regulations, and public order in Haredi neighborhoods, what you get are de facto autonomous zones where state infrastructure projects become negotiation points rather than public services.
When the negotiation doesn't produce the outcome the activists want, the next step is direct action. 600 million shekels in damage. 2 years of additional construction disruption for everyone else in Jerusalem. This isn't protest. This is sabotage of public infrastructure funded by taxpayers who are being told their money is being burned because a train might bring secular influences near a neighborhood.
The mechanism is clear. Political power buys exemptions. Exemptions create dependency. Dependency requires more political power to maintain. And when political power isn't enough, you get physical sabotage. But this isn't just a problem for the Haredi community. It's creating cascading crises across Israeli society.
Let's talk about the IDF, because this is where the rubber meets the road. The Israeli military has always operated on the People's Army model. Universal conscription creates shared sacrifice, shared citizenship. That model is breaking down. When 28% of draft-age males are exempted, the burden falls disproportionately on the secular and national religious communities. These are the same communities that are paying the taxes that fund the yeshiva stipends. The IDF made a decision in 2025 that didn't get enough attention. They reduced mandatory combat service from 32 months to 28 months, citing budget constraints.
They shortened combat service because of budget pressure, while the state is spending $4.2 billion on yeshiva stipends.
That's the direct connection. The cost of maintaining the exemption system, not just the stipends, but the administrative apparatus, the enforcement avoidance, the political capital, directly reduces the resources available for actual defense. And the morale impact is harder to quantify, but arguably more damaging. You have combat soldiers doing multiple tours, reserve duty into their 40s, and they look across and see a community that not only doesn't serve, but actively opposes the state that the soldiers are defending.
Daniel's question gets at something uncomfortable here. Is it fair to call the Haredi community an internal enemy? That's strong language.
I think we need to be precise. The Haredi community as a whole is not an enemy of the state. Many Haredim are law-abiding, quietly get on with their lives, and some serve and work despite community pressure. But the political leadership and the activist core that carried out the light rail sabotage are operating in a way that is functionally indistinguishable from internal opposition to the state's existence. Compare this to other internal challenges Israel faces. Arab-Israeli political parties. They operate within the democratic system, they don't sabotage infrastructure, they don't reject the legitimacy of the state's institutions, even when they criticize policy. Settler extremists engage in violence, but they don't combine it with demographic growth, political power, economic dependency, and institutional sabotage. The Haredi case is unique because it's a quadruple threat. No other group presents all four dimensions simultaneously.
The demographic dimension is what makes this different from any other political conflict. Political movements come and go. Demographics are a freight train. If the projections hold, 25% by 2035, potentially 30% by 2050, the economic model simply stops working. You can't have a third of your population outside the workforce and outside the military while receiving state transfers without triggering a fiscal crisis. So what happens then?
There are three scenarios that serious analysts model. Scenario 1, economic collapse and austerity. The secular tax base shrinks relative to the dependent population. The state can't borrow indefinitely. Eventually, you get a Greece-style debt crisis, forced austerity, and a vicious political backlash. Scenario 2, a constitutional crisis. The secular majority, seeing the state's institutions captured by a minority that rejects those institutions, pushes for fundamental constitutional reform, perhaps requiring a 65-seat threshold to form a government, which would break the kingmaker power of small sectarian parties. Scenario 3, gradual integration driven by economic necessity. Even within the Haredi community, there are growing numbers, particularly among younger Haredim, who want to work, who see the poverty, and don't want it for their children. If workforce participation can be nudged above 55%, the trajectory starts to shift.
That third scenario is the hopeful one, but it requires incentives that don't currently exist. And that gets us to the question Daniel is really asking, what can actually be done? What options are on the table?
I see three realistic policy paths, ranked by feasibility. Option 1, economic incentives, the stick-and-carrot model. This has been tried with some success in the UK with Orthodox Jewish communities in Manchester and London. You condition state benefits on participation in vocational training and workforce integration programs. You offer tax credits for Haredi-owned businesses that hire within the community. You phase out yeshiva stipends for able-bodied men under 40 and replace them with education grants that require core curriculum standards. The advantage is that it doesn't require a constitutional showdown. The disadvantage is that it takes a generation and requires political will that the current coalition structure actively prevents.
Because the parties that would need to pass these reforms are the same parties whose power depends on blocking them.
Option 2, constitutional reform. Raise the threshold for forming a government to 65 seats. This would force the large parties, Likud, National Unity, Yesh Atid, to form broader coalitions without being held hostage by parties with 8 or 9 seats. It's the most elegant solution from a governance perspective, but it requires a constitutional amendment, which requires a supermajority, which requires Haredi parties to vote for their own diminished power. That's not happening.
Option 2 is a fantasy dressed up as a policy paper.
In the current political environment, yes. Option 3 is what I'd call the hard path. Enforce conscription with real penalties, budget cuts to yeshivas that don't teach core curriculum, and federal oversight of municipal governance in Haredi-majority cities to prevent the de facto autonomous zones. This would trigger a coalition collapse, early elections, and possibly civil unrest on a scale that makes the light rail sabotage look like a picnic.
The realistic menu is slow economic pressure that might work over 20 years, constitutional reform that can't pass, or enforcement that blows up the government. That's not a menu. That's a trap.
That's why the Bank of Israel is sounding the alarm. That's why the IDF is quietly planning for a future where the People's Army model no longer functions. And that's why the light rail sabotage matters beyond the 600 million shekels. It's the canary in the coal mine. When a community moves from political negotiation to physical destruction of state infrastructure, it signals that the existing framework for managing the conflict has failed.
Let's address a misconception that Daniel nodded at in his prompt. He acknowledged, "This is a generalization. Not all Haredim hold these views. How significant is the moderate faction?"
It's significant and growing, but politically weak. The Haredim National Religious Haredim are a fascinating case. They serve in the military, often in combat units. They work in the tech sector. They maintain religious observance while participating fully in the modern economy and state institutions. They're proof that the theological objections to Zionism are not insurmountable. But they're a minority within the Haredi world, and the political leadership. The rabbinical councils that issue voting instructions are dominated by the isolationist faction. The moderates are a sociological fact, but not yet a political force.
Which is another way of saying the system is designed to suppress the moderates. If you control the education system, you control what the next generation believes is possible. If you control the voting instructions, you control who gets elected. The moderate Haredi who wants to work and serve has to overcome both community pressure and institutional barriers.
That's where the education piece becomes so critical. The separate Haredi education system, the one funded by those 4.2 billion shekels, does not teach math, English, or science at the level required for university admission or modern employment. This is not an oversight. It's a deliberate choice to maintain separation. A young Haredi man who finishes yeshiva at 22 has a religious education that is deep and rigorous by its own standards, but he cannot read a contract, cannot use a computer, cannot qualify for any profession that requires a license. The system has designed him for dependency.
When we talk about workforce participation, we're not talking about people who are lazy or unwilling. We're talking about people who have been systematically denied the tools to participate by a leadership that benefits from their isolation.
That's the tragedy of it, and it's why the moral framing of this issue is so difficult. The individual Haredi man who throws a rock at a light rail construction site is acting on beliefs that were deliberately cultivated by a system that benefits from his alienation. He's both perpetrator and victim of the same structure.
Daniel also asked specifically how Israeli politicians have grappled with this over the years. What's the political history in brief?
In brief, they haven't. They've managed it, which is different from grappling with it. Every prime minister since Rabin has acknowledged the problem privately and avoided it publicly. Sharon tried to co-opt Shas into a broader coalition and finesse the issue. Olmert talked about civil unions and sharing the burden, but never legislated. Netanyahu perfected the art of paying the Haredi parties just enough to keep the coalition together while doing nothing structural. Bennett attempted some education reforms and got toppled. Lapid ran on equality in service in 2013 and 2022 and couldn't form a stable coalition without the Haredi parties either time. The pattern is consistent: campaign on reform, govern on accommodation.
Because the math of coalition politics makes accommodation the only viable short-term strategy, no one wants to be the prime minister who triggered the coalition collapse that led to elections where the right-wing bloc loses power. The personal political cost of reform is higher than the national cost of inaction, until it isn't.
The light rail sabotage may be the moment where that calculus starts to shift. When the cost of inaction becomes visible, physical, and expensive in ways that voters can see and feel, the political incentives change. 600 million shekels is a number that lands. 2 years of construction delays affect every Jerusalem resident who sits in traffic. This is no longer an abstract debate about sharing the burden. It's a train line that isn't running because a group of rioters decided to destroy it.
If a listener wants to track whether this crisis is getting better or worse, what should they watch for?
First, the next Supreme Court ruling on the service targets law. The court struck down the blanket exemption in 2025. The coalition passed a replacement that creates targets without enforcement. The court is going to have to rule on whether that replacement meets the constitutional standard of equality. If they strike it down again, and they might, we're looking at a full-blown constitutional crisis between the judiciary and the Knesset. The 2027 state budget negotiations. Watch the yeshiva allocation line. If it goes up, which it has every year for a decade, that tells you the political dynamic hasn't changed. If it stays flat or decreases, that's a signal that even coalition partners are starting to feel the fiscal pressure. Third signal, Haredi male workforce participation. The number to watch is 55%. If it crosses that threshold, the economic integration argument starts to win on its own terms. If it stays at 50% or drops, the dependency trap tightens.
Those are concrete, trackable metrics. That's helpful. So let's land this. You've laid out a structural crisis with no easy exits. The light rail is a symptom of a much deeper problem. The question Daniel ended with, is this a pipeline waiting to explode? Seems to answer itself.
The pipeline isn't waiting to explode. It's already leaking. The question is whether the pressure can be released gradually through economic integration and political reform, or whether it builds until something ruptures. And ruptures in multi-ethnic democracies are not theoretical. We've seen them in Belgium, in Northern Ireland, in Lebanon. The difference in Israel is that the demographic trajectory means time is not on the side of the status quo.
The train will eventually run through Haredi neighborhoods. The question is whether Israeli society will still be on board when it does. Can a liberal democracy survive when a significant and growing minority actively rejects its foundational principles while simultaneously demanding its resources? That's not a rhetorical question. It's the live experiment Israel is running right now, and the results are not yet in.
That's where we'll pick up next time, looking at how other democracies have handled similar internal legitimacy crises. Northern Ireland, Belgium, the United States during its own periods of internal fracture. The Israeli case is unique in its specifics, but the pattern of a subgroup rejecting state legitimacy while wielding political power within it is not unprecedented. There are lessons, and there are warnings.
Before we go, it's time for Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In the 1840s, the British Royal Navy measured the depth of uncharted waters using a lead line marked in fathoms, one fathom being 6 feet. If you convert the average depth of the Simpson Desert's groundwater table, roughly 100 meters, into fathoms, you get about 55 fathoms. Which means a 19th century British sailor would describe the water under one of the driest places on Earth as 55 fathoms and not a drop to drink.
Oh, right. This has been my Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want more episodes like this one, you can find us at myweirdprompts.com. We're back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My Weird Prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My Weird Prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.